tonight. It's 8 o'clock sharp almost. Thank you for sticking around. I'm honored to introduce the last program of the day, or the last presentation of the day. Field Officer Director Keith Brown and his adjudicator Annabelle, this is their third visit. And they have been doing amazing work for the last 5 years. Since I met them, we kind of lost track. They came out of their comfort zone and gave information everywhere, English and Spanish, facilitated all kinds of information to different communities. Immigration is a very difficult theme, topic to understand, and I think it is important for us to have him explain to you a little bit of what might you like to know about the naturalization process, since they will be naturalizing 50 of our folks here tomorrow. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome, Keith Brown.
Okay, so we're talking about citizenship and how you become a United States citizen, and there's a whole laundry list of congressional laws, and you have to meet all of these requirements before you can actually become a citizen. So it starts with two simple ones. You have to be at least 18 years of age, and you have to be a lawful permanent resident of the United States. You have to be a legal immigrant here in the U.S., which getting to that point is a whole different story and different class, and takes much more time than citizenship. All right, so you're 18, you got a lawful permanent resident card. Normally, in order to apply for citizenship, you have to have had your green card for 5 years before you are eligible to submit your application. Okay? But if you have had your green card for 3 years and you are married to a U.S. citizen and you've been married to a U.S. citizen for 3 years, and it's the same U.S. citizen, then you can apply for citizenship at the 3 year period. Okay? If you join the military, you can actually apply for citizenship under one section of the law after you've had your green card for 1 year. In actuality, now when you join the military, the recruiter fills out all of the paperwork for citizenship, and that goes off with the individual to basic training. And while they're at basic training, it's all completed, and before they graduate, they become U.S. citizens. After that, after you've met the 5 years or the 3 years, and that period is very important because we consider that period the statutory period. Every other thing we think about statute-wise all goes back to usually within those periods of time, the 5 years or the 3 years before you apply for citizenship, okay? So the next thing you have to have is you have to have lived in the district in which you apply 3 months before you turn in your application, okay? And my particular area is District 20. District 20 is all of Washington, all of Oregon, all of Alaska, and the top 10 northern counties of Idaho. If you've lived in any of that area for the last 3 months, then you are eligible to send in your application and you won't have problems with that particular part of the law. If you move up to here or you move to a different district, you're going to have to live there for 3 months before you apply. Now, if you've lived here for 3 years or 3 months, and then you apply, and then you move to California, it's okay because you lived in the district you applied in for the 3 month period before you sent the application. So you're not tied to that one district while this is all going on. You can move to a different area if you need to, okay? And the next thing you must have is continuous residence in the United States. Basically, continuous residence is a law that Congress enacted to make sure that you spend enough of that five-year period or that three-year period inside the United States so that you are getting exposed to the customs and laws of the country in which you're going to become a citizen. So, what Congress has is a little law that says if you leave the United States and you stay gone continuously for 1 year or more, before you can apply for citizenship, when you come back from that year-long or whatever trip, you have to wait for 4 years and 1 day before you apply to become a U.S. citizen. That's assuming you have the five-year statutory period. If it is a three-year period, then you have to wait for 2 years and 1 day after you return before you can apply for citizenship. Okay. Now, if you're gone continuously between 6 months and 1 year, you have to show that you have maintained ties to the United States. You still pay your taxes, you still have a bank account, maybe you're paying a mortgage. Anything that will show us that you just didn't pull up everything, leave the country, and stay gone. As long as you can show us some ties back here from the 6 months to 1 year period, won't be a problem. And then you must have physical presence in the United States, which is different than continuous presence. Okay. Basically, Congress also says that in that five-year period or in that three-year period, half of that time, your feet had to be inside the U.S. Okay? You can make as many short trips as you want to outside the U.S. You can go for 5 months to Canada or 2 months to New Zealand, or, you know, wherever you want to travel. But if all of those trips add up to more than half of that five-year period or half of that three-year period, then you will have to wait until half of that time that you're required to be here, you've been here. So. For 5 years, it is 912
finally, you got
days
it.
That you have had to have spent in that five-year period.
Don't ask me the three, because I have no idea.
So you better inside
the United States. For the three-year period, 18 months, you have to be inside the U.S. Okay.
Who keeps track?
Yeah, who keeps track?
What happens is, part of the application process is, you have to list every single trip you have made in and out of the United States in that five-year period.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay, or the three-year period. And we're going to ask you to bring your passport to the interview. And we're going to look at that and see if it matches up. We will also run you in a system that's called U.S. Visit, which tracks every entrance and every exit you make from the United States, and we're going to match that up and make sure all of those are exactly the same. Okay.
What if you don't remember all the dates?
And you're going to do I went to Canada, I was gone 3 days sometime in, November. I don't know, 2012, okay? So you can estimate it, all right? We don't expect everybody to remember every little single trip that they make outside the U.S. And if you're in the general ballpark, it's going to probably be okay. But if you are over that 912-day period, okay, and it's not estimated, but it's actual departure dates and return dates, then that is going to make you ineligible for, to become a citizen at that time, okay?
So,
yes, ma'am.
So up to this point, this is just the criteria to make you eligible to
apply. Yeah, we haven't even got to the interview
process
or anything yet.
So at this point, I've heard numbers in the state of Washington or in your district, how many people are already at that level?
There
eligible
are
to apply.
It's gone up lately. The last numbers I saw in Washington State there are approximately 185,000 individuals who are eligible for citizenship but have not applied yet for various reasons.
Huge.
If you meet the two qualifications, which one, are there different forms on each of them?
There's just different, there's different sections of the same form that you're gonna fill out, which, and those sections of the form are gonna cover all the sections of law that I've just been talking about. So how you answer that question is going to tell us if you meet that particular part of congressional law.
So that's what Hand in Hand does, is help people understand what their rights are and where they can
to walk the 21-page form.
Yeah, that's
to facilitate a lot of information, even gathering the days that left the country could take hours to assist. Wow.
When I first started adjudicating those applications, they were 3 pages, and I had every question on that form memorized for the interview. Fortunately, I don't have to do interviews anymore, but Annabelle does. Most of the extensions on that form that caused it to become 21 pages are all the requirements enacted by Congress and signed by the various presidents after 9/11.
Yep.
Okay, to meet all the requirements of the new laws that Congress passed. And so we're required to go into all these areas that used to be just a general question. And the general question was, have you ever been a member of a terrorist organization? Okay. Now, that terrorist organization thing is, you know, I don't know, a couple of pages long. Just on that part, okay? All right, so we have got through physical presence, continuous residency, we are up to good moral character. All right, so the next thing you have to have in the 5-year period or the 3-year statutory period before you apply is good moral character, okay? And there are like 9 million court cases out there and decisions on what is and what is not good moral character. And depending on what federal appellate authority you reside under, the laws are different. Ninth Circuit is very liberal, okay? And where something in our Ninth Circuit area might not be a problem because of the precedent decision that they published in another more conservative federal appellate authority, it would be. Okay, so you got to know where you are applying in and what is going to be a problem.
I forgive my ignorance of the federal court system, but do those appellate jurisdiction areas, does that line up with the district you were referencing earlier?
No, because in Ninth Circuit goes all the way over to like somewhere in Arizona, that area, California, up the West Coast. Mm-hmm. Either most of the districts in my western region, which is in Laguna Niguel, California, are actually south of us in California, Arizona, Nevada, all of that area is under the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Okay. All right. So for good, yes, sir.
Are you referring to, say, a misdemeanor violation in one district would be compromise your moral character, and the other would be?
It kind of depends, because one appellate authority, the Ninth Circuit or the Fifth Circuit or whatever, will make different decisions on the same type of case. When that happens, then it's normally going to be taken up by the Supreme Court eventually for an overall ruling nationally on what that particular issue is. The last thing that affected us quite a bit was the Supreme Court ruling. I don't remember the name, but it had to do with crimes involving moral turpitude and what is a CIMT and what is not. And they came out with, it used to be really simple. Here's a list of crimes involving moral turpitude. Flip through the list, arson, okay. Crime of moral turpitude. All right. Burglary, yeah. Okay, you can look up the crime and it either is or isn't on the list. Well, they came out with this way of figuring out, based upon state law, okay, whether it is a crime of moral turpitude. For instance, in Washington and in Oregon, what used to be a CIMT, a crime involving moral turpitude of theft, as in shoplifting was a CIMT, it's theft, okay? However, when the Supreme Court decision came out, you don't have to do all of this figuring out of whether it is a categorical CIMT or a modified categorical CIMT, and that depends on the state law. And in Washington State, in order for theft to be a CIMT, it not only has to be theft, but it has to have an intent to deprive the other person permanently of their property. Okay? And if that element is not in the conviction, then it's not a CIMT. Okay, so if you're taking a car, well, actually, a car is a bad example because joyriding never was a CIMT. But if you're shoplifting in a store and you take a candy bar, okay, and one would assume that you're intending to permanently deprive the store of that candy bar. But unless that element is in the conviction to permanently deprive and in the law, as the way the Washington state law is written, then it's not a crime involving moral turpitude in this case, based upon the way the Washington state law is, shoplifting and theft three are no longer CIMTs, and it's like that for every crime. Where, like I said, where we used to have an easy list that said yes, 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 no. Now it takes forever to figure out. A lot of times we get a hold of our internal attorneys, our agency attorneys, and they look specifically at that state's law and figure out yes or no, and then they let all of the field offices know that, no, we've looked at this, it's not.
Are there ever any opportunities for mitigating circumstances?
Not for CIMTs.
Really?
Okay. If it's a CIMT in the statutory period, you may not become a United States citizen.
Why?
Okay. It's just that simple. The statute for GMC, good moral character, is divided up into permanent bars that will forever bar you from becoming a U.S. citizen, to statutory bars within the statutory 5-year period, to some other lower level offenses that may not bar you from becoming, but in those cases you can submit your explanation for that particular issue. It's called an unlawful act. And then we can decide based upon your explanation of what to hold it against you or not.
So for the second level down, where it's just, it's not barring you forever, you'd have to wait another 5 years?
5 years from the date of the conviction. Okay. So from the date of the arrest, because the day after the arrest, you have started accruing good moral character again. You were bad on that one day. You were bad on that day, but the next day you were good. Whether you're in jail or not, it's a different matter, but you're good. So you start accruing good moral character at that point in time. Some things you can never overcome. Murder. Murder, rape, anything that's an aggravated felony, that's considered an aggravated felony, you will never, ever, ever become a U.S. citizen. Okay? An immigration judge can forgive you for that and let you stay here as a lawful permanent resident, but you will never, ever, ever become a U.S. citizen, okay? All right, so good moral character, and we talked about the main things, and then the other thing that you were asking about there were the unlawful acts provision. For unlawful acts, we look at things like driving under the influence, domestic violence, 4, Sometimes things that are tied into driving under the influence, like driving with a suspended license, because your license was suspended because you were driving under the influence, okay? Things of that nature. And in that case, you were allowed to present to us exceptional circumstances which might mitigate our decision on your case within that 5-year period. Okay? Things like running a stop sign or fishing out of season or driving without insurance are not a good moral character issue. Okay? And the thing is, a good moral character goes from 5 years before you apply up to the actual date that you take the oath of allegiance to the United States. So if you come to my office and you pass the test and you're all happy, you go out and celebrate, and you get picked up for DUI, when you come for your ceremony, we're going to pull you from the ceremony and say, hey, by the way, you got to wait 5 years.
Is that convicted or not?
Arrest.
Just arrest.
Okay, it's arrest, because now we don't know if you have good moral character or not at the oath time. Okay, so we're going to pull you from that ceremony. We will revisit our approval, and we will send out a notice to you. We have, the information we have says that you were arrested for driving under the influence of that date. We intend to reverse our grant of your application and deny it. You have 30 days to respond why we should not. Okay. And then at the end of that 30-day period, if they haven't responded, we'll reopen it and deny it. If they have responded, we'll look at it and make a decision whether we're going to reopen and deny it. Okay?
Can I just make an observation? I've lived here my whole life. Probably would not be allowed to become a citizen right now.
That's what I was thinking, too.
I speak English. I'm familiar with the United States culture. I can't imagine. I'm overwhelmed just listening to you about the process. I just can't imagine how hard it is for folks that are eligible.
You know, the toughest part these days is filling out the application.
That's
the toughest part.
And then maybe
through FAFSA.
Jumping ahead just to remind people why. Why would someone come and what are the
why reasons? Would you become a U.S. citizen?
What if you've been here for a long time and under...
Well, first off, you can't vote and have a say in the way you want the country to proceed. Okay? You cannot travel on a U.S. passport because you can't be issued one. You cannot hold a federal job. And most importantly, you are subject as a lawful permanent resident to a long, long laundry list of federal law that makes you deportable from the United States. Okay? 35 or 39 different federal laws that make you deportable from the U.S. Okay?
How about once you become a U.S. citizen, can that be...
No, U.S. citizens, we just put you in jail. Now, that is normally the case, but depending on the circumstances, and it's really rare, we can go back after that citizenship from a person who's naturalized. And the last person I know of that we did that to was about 3 years ago now. Individual back in Ohio was found out to be one of the guards at, I think it was Treblinka in Eastern Europe during World War II, one of the extermination camps.
I remember seeing
And Germany wanted him back, okay? But you can't extradite a U.S. citizen for that particular crime. So the federal government went back for this guy's citizenship, and it wound its way up finally to the Supreme Court, who made the final decision on revoking the individual citizenship and deporting him to Germany.
That was a pretty extreme example.
Well, the thing is, if you did not disclose something to us, during your application process, and you hid that information from us, and it's serious information that would have caused us to deny your application, in theory, we can go back using the judicial process to get your naturalization back and denaturalize you. But it can only be done by federal judges. It started out in a circuit court, probably here, wind its way up to the Ninth Circuit, and from the Ninth Circuit, you can appeal that all the way to the Supreme Court. Doable, but it's hard.
So in other words, though, other than that exception, does a naturalized citizen have the same exact rights as a...
Same exact rights, same exact responsibilities as every other U.S. citizen. Okay.
Keith, what would be some of those 35 or 39 federal laws that would cause a person to lose
to be deported? One or more crimes involving moral turpitude with a sentence of 5 years or more. Let's see, what else have we got? Any terrorist act? Fraud, misrep, entry into the country when you get your green card would make you deportable. What else have we got out there? Well, I see them all the time, but let's see. You've got, I keep thinking of inadmissibility charges because you got those to start with, but let's see. Deportability charges. Any aggravated felony would make you deportable from the United States, murder, rape, anything of that nature. Any sexual abuse of a child would make you deportable from the United States. Domestic violence could make you deportable from the United States, although it doesn't make you inadmissible to the United States, because those are a different set of laws. It just goes on and on. And the thing about deportability charges is there are very, very few waivers available for deportability charges. A lot of inadmissibility charges, there's waivers for. Okay, but deportability, really light on the waiver provision. Because you've been admitted and expected, you've been living here, you should know the laws of the country, and if you violate it to that extent, why should we give you a waiver? Okay?
We actually see a lot of DUIs, a lot of domestic violence, a lot of families that are being deported, parents, because somebody called police, they were arguing, ended up in the police department, and we see a lot of that. People that have been here 30, 40, 50, 60 years legally, we see those folks here, and if they were naturalized, become U.S. citizen, ended up in jail as a citizen, they would still be here, but if you're not, so.
You break the whole family up and send one of the parents away.
They just didn't know. There was no access to the information, and they speak perfect English, and it's sad to see that happening in our community so often.
So I might be getting out of order for your presentation, but if there's 185,000 potential cases, how many do you process a year?
Depends on the field office. Seattle, the last time I looked at their numbers was about 13,000-14,000 a year. Portland was about half of that, about 6,000 or 7,000 a year. Alaska, I don't know. 300 or 400 a year. Yakima is about 1,400 to 1,500 a year. Spokane is probably around 800 to 900.
Is Yakima the nearest one to here?
Yes, Yakima. My jurisdiction is basically the center part of the state, going starting from Kittitas, Klickitat, Benton, Franklin, Grant, Yakima County. Chelan and Douglas County, kind of up the middle of the state. I've got 8 counties. That's the Yakima field office. Sir?
It may sound intimidating, everything that Officer Keith has been saying, but I would like to interject that in the years that our immigration justice group from Faith Lutheran has been involved with Officer Keith and Officer Annabelle, we have found them to be very gracious, very cordial, very helping in answering our questions, providing materials, coming to visit us, doing mock interviews and presentations. We have just found them to be almost, you guys work for the government? You're just outstanding.
They're calling the people.
We are people.
And we are here to help.
Yeah. Very much so.
Keith, can you briefly explain to me about a little bit about all the things people had to do to prepare after the application and the
time? Yeah, we're going to get to that.
Okay. there's questions. All right, that's good moral character here. And then the last requirement, mostly the last thing, I shouldn't say the last requirement, but the last thing you do before you become a United States citizen is going to happen tomorrow when we have a naturalization ceremony and these individuals take the oath of allegiance and attach themselves to the Constitution of the United States. Okay? Now, it takes about roughly 3 months from the time they send their application in to the time that they are in my office being interviewed, okay? So it's not that long a period. And the requirement is when they come in for the interview, they are going to be normally tested on their speaking and understanding English, reading and writing English, and the civics test, okay? For speaking and understanding English, we're going to take that 21-page application and we're going to go over it with them in English. As long as they understand the questions and respond appropriately to them, they will pass that part of the English test requirement. Okay, and we will break some of those concepts down as far as we possibly can to give them every benefit of the doubt to pass the English speaking and understanding portion. Okay. After that, they have to be able to read and write English. And what my officers will do, they'll pull a sheet of paper that has a computer-generated list of three sentences on it. And they'll ask them to read the first sentence on that list. As soon as they get one of those questions correct, we stop that part of the test, they pass. So if they pass and read the first sentence correctly, they have passed the test. We don't bother with the other two.
Will you give an example of a sentence?
The White House is in Washington, D.C.
That's a lot of the teaching that we prepare them for classes.
Okay. But there's flashcards. So in reality, we give them flashcards.
I just did the GRE flashcards. I'm familiar with flashcards.
Well, these flashcards are broken up into reading and writing. And they are all the words that we would ask them to read and all the words we would ask them to write. So if the reading word, if it's not in there, we won't ask them to read that in a sentence. Just the ones that are on that list, or on those cards.
I'm not sure I could spell moral turpitude.
Well, that's not on the card, so no. The words on the cards, the test is based depending on who you talk to, about a fourth grade education level, third to fourth grade, okay? And we'll do the same thing for the writing test. We randomly pull a piece of paper, it's got three sentences on it, and we ask them to write, we'll read the first one and ask them to write it. Long as they get the first one correct, we don't bother with the other two. For the writing test, if they miss a word, but it doesn't change, they leave out a word, doesn't change the meaning of the sentence, we're fine. If they misspell a word, but we can still understand what that word was supposed to be, it's okay, we'll pass them on that part of the test. Doesn't have to be perfect, okay? Same thing for the history test, the civics test, there's 100 questions. My officers will randomly pull a piece of paper that's got 10 of those questions on them, and they will go in order, starting with the very first one. As soon as the applicant gets 6 questions correct, we stop the test, that's it, they passed, okay? If they miss one, we'll go on to number 7. If they miss that one, we'll go on to number 8. But usually when they come in, it's 1 through 6, okay?
Our failure
rate for civics is probably about
5 to 6%. Okay, it's not very much. And if they do fail any part of the test, we will have them come back 60 to 90 days later, somewhere in that 60 to 90 day period, and we will retest them again on the part of the test that they failed, and only that part of the test. Okay, so they get 60 days to study that part.
Sorry to interrupt.
That's right.
Someone said that if you're legally resident for over 15 years, can you take
it? Haven't got there yet.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Do children ever get naturalized with their parents, minor children?
That's a whole different section of law.
Okay.
However, very quickly, that section of law these days is Section 320 of the Immigration Nationality Act, and basically, a individual who has children who are a lawful permanent resident and are under the age of 18 automatically acquire citizenship at the same time their parents do. Okay? All right, so we have passed the test, or we've given them 60 days to retake the test, come back in, we'll ask that part of the test, and that's pretty much it. Now, some people are exempt from all of the English language requirements. They do not need to speak, read, or write English. And those individuals are, if you've had your green card for 50 years, and you are 50 years of age. 50 years old, 20 years with your card. Gotta have both. 50 and 20. You are exempt from all of the English language requirements. We will do the entire interview in your native language. Okay, whatever that native language is. And if I don't have an officer to speak it, we dial a number, put the phone on speakerphone, and we can get any language interpreter we want through that service. Okay, and we do it on speakerphone in the office. If you are 55 years old and you've had your green card for 15 years, you are exempt all of the English language requirements. We'll do everything in your native language, including the civics test. And if you are 65 years old and you have had your green card for 20 years, not only are you exempt all of the English language requirements, but you only have to study 20 of the 100 civics questions. And you get told what those 20 are. You only study those. So when my officers pull that list of 10 questions, that list of 10 is from those 20. And as soon as you get 6 right, you pass the test. Is there anything I've forgotten?
The cost. The cost.
The cost for applying for citizenship is $680. If the individual is receiving any type of means-tested public benefit, such as SSI or food stamps or anything like that, they can apply for a fee waiver and have the fee waived. If they make less than 150% of the federal poverty guidelines, they can do the same thing. Okay, you can get a fee waiver. Okay, yes, ma'am.
What about people with disabilities?
People with disabilities, as far as the English and civics test is concerned, there's a form that they can take to a doctor, and if the doctor says they have a medical condition that prevents them from learning new information, my officers have the ability to waive the English requirements. Depends on how the doctor writes it up. There's specific instructions for the doctors on how to do it and how to link whatever it is they have with the learning disability. Okay? Just because I cut off my thumb doesn't prevent me from learning new information. Okay? But if I have dementia, okay, then that's a medical condition that prevents you from learning new information, and the doctor could write that up and we would provide the medical exemption for the English and civics test, both of them, depending on how the doctor wrote it up. I've gotten ones from doctors that said on the medical forum, there's absolutely no reason this individual cannot learn civics and English. Okay.
So what do we have before we send them off to home?
You need to find a new doctor, or you need to study English. Let's see, I think that's pretty much it. What other questions can I answer for you?
So is the fee based on something?
USCIS, by congressional law, is not funded by Congress. Okay? Congress said it is up to the immigrants and it's up to the individuals that want this benefit to pay for the fee that's required to process all of this. The US government and the taxpayers should not have to do that. So, we are required to ensure that we're not losing money and we're not making money. Okay? And we have to, my leadership in Washington has to go before Congress on a set period of time and show the budget and say, okay, this is where we are. These are all the laws you've enacted. This is how much it's costing us to do this, and we're losing money. We need to raise fees. Or we're fine and we don't need a fee raise. And Congress says, well, we don't want to raise fees right now for whatever reason, and we suck it up and figure out how to do what it is we have to do. Okay, but that's why the fees are so high, is we're not taxpayer funded.
Aren't these people who've had green cards for 5, 10, or 20 years taxpayers? Are they not paying?
I'm not Congress, ma'am. you have to address that to Mr. Reichert or whoever. Okay, the congressional law is U.S. citizen taxpayers will not pay for benefits, okay, that the individual applying for immigration benefits must pay that fee themselves, and by congressional law, we have to go through that process. So,
if I were a citizen of Mexico, living in Mexico, and wanted to come to this country and be a citizen, I'm sure there's lots of barriers before what you have mentioned.
Well, that would be getting legal in the U.S. to start with, yeah, which is a whole other hour and a half class or so.
Can you give a 5-second summary?
The 5-second summary is that immigration into the United States is primarily based upon two things. It's based upon family affiliations and employment, and mostly on family affiliations. If you are a U.S. citizen, you can petition your spouse, your child, and your parents into the United States. You can also petition your married sons and daughters, your unmarried sons and daughters, and your brothers and sisters, okay? For spouse, child, and parent of U.S. citizens, those are all exempt any visa requirements that Congress has set, so they're always able to come directly into the United States in a fairly short amount of time. Every other family member requires a visa number. Congress sets the number of visa numbers for every category every month, ships those off to the State Department, because the State Department is where immigrants are supposed to come from. They're supposed to be outside the United States when you immigrate. State Department then takes some computer program and farms those out to all of the family-based categories. F-1, 6, unmarried son or daughter of a U.S. citizen, F2A is the spouse of a lawful permanent resident, F2B is the unmarried son or daughter of a lawful permanent resident, and F3 is the married son or daughter of a U.S. citizen, and F4 is the brother or sister of a U.S. citizen. And then they divide it up into your high-value countries, not high-value, but where you get most of the immigrants wanting to come from these days, India, China, Mexico, what's the fourth one?
Philippines,
all right? And now there's a huge waiting line for those countries, okay? So if you wanted to petition and you wanted your brother here from the Philippines today, right now, in order for us to have a visa available for that individual right now, they should have sent us a petition for that alien relative about 14 years ago.
Or longer,
in order for there to be a visa. I think Philippines is usually the longest. Mm-hmm. I think the Philippines is up about 18 or 19 years for brother or sister of a U.S. citizen.
But Mexico, you're up at 20.
Mexico is a long time, China's a long time, India is a long time, because there's lots and lots and lots of people that want to come in from those countries. They have the same type of system for employment-based. You have employment-based one, which are aliens of extraordinary ability. These are the best of the best in their field. If you were in that field, you would know them. You would know them internationally, okay, if you were in that field. All right, they petition for themselves to come into the United States. Right? That's how much we want them. And there's always a visa available for them, okay, because they're that good.
I was wondering, I'm not sure if you said it in the beginning, but you said you had to be 5 years in the United States of America.
As a lawful permanent resident.
Okay, yeah. So it can't be as a temporary guest here.
No, got to be as a lawful permanent resident.
Okay, yeah.
Employment base two is like PhDs and things like that. Employment base and doctors, things, people we really need here into specialized professions. Then you get the people with master's degrees, that's a little lower on. And then finally at the bottom is unskilled labor, which is employment-based four, if I remember correctly. Sir?
Dual citizenships and things like that?
Up to the other country, the U.S. does not recognize dual citizenship. As far as they are concerned, you have taken an oath of allegiance to the Constitution of the United States, and you belong to us. If another country still recognizes you as a citizen of their country, there's absolutely nothing we can do about that.
Two questions. They're both pretty quick. The first one, based on your terminology, lawful permanent resident, do people who come to study in college, is that a separate?
That is a student visa. That's a non-immigrant visa to come into the country and study here in the United States with. The intent is you're coming in to study, and then you're departing the United States back to your home country.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. How many people in your office? You know, we talk about
in Yakima.
Well, sorry, in general, we talk about in the state of Washington, 180,000 or so people. How many people do you have to work with?
Well, I've got I'm authorized 6 adjudication officers in my office. I've got 4 these days. Seattle, I don't remember, they're a lot bigger. Portland's got about roughly 30 adjudication officers. Spokane's got about 3, Anchorage's got about 3. I would guess Seattle probably has about 60. Yeah, maybe a little 50 to 60 adjudication officers, something like that. Maybe a little less than that. I really don't have time to track the other offices because I gotta
take
care of mine.
What's the path to get into your line of work?
U.S. citizen, all federal jobs mostly these days are on the internet. You can go to USA Jobs, look up whatever federal agency you wish to work for, and submit your application and your resume and everything online for that particular job in that particular place of the country.
So you said that you have 4, but you're authorized for 6. Does that mean you're going to hire 2 if they showed up in your door?
Well, one was given to Portland because they're short of people. So although I still have that position, I'm not allowed to fill it because it's been offset as an overhire by Portland. The other one I'm announcing as an ISO 1.
He went to Kansas.
What's that?
Didn't one of them just went to Kansas?
Yeah, I just had one leave for Kansas. I may have another one leaving for Dallas. I've got 2 levels of immigration service officer. I've got an ISO 1, got an ISO 2. ISO 2s are actually, like Annabelle, do the actual interviews and adjudications on applications for where people have to appear in person. ISO 1, which I'm attempting to hire, takes care of my front counter and the public that comes in, answers written requests, written inquiries for the status of cases, and I really need that in my office more than I do another ISO 2. Sir?
I was going to ask, for employment visas, is the waiting list a little shorter than
family? It depends on the visa. I looked at the employment-based last time we were in with Nancy. used to be long. I'm looking at it now, a lot of it's current. It'll have to have a big C on the visa bulletin, which means it's current, which means if you apply, there's a visa available. There was only a couple that had a waiting period, and that even those were really, really short. It was only a couple of years. When I first started, the unskilled labor was like 14, 15, 16 years. Now it's... The other one you can get in the get legal in the U.S. is you can submit your name in a lottery drawing. And Congress has set aside 50,000 visa numbers for the lottery. You send your stuff in from that particular country. And if your name is drawn from the millions of names that are submitted for the lottery, you've just got yourself a green card. The other way to get one is if you have $500,000. And you want to invest it in Chelan, Washington.
Chelan Wenatchee.
In a pizza business or whatever, and you can show that you're creating a certain number of jobs, you can get a green card. If you wanted to do the same thing in Seattle or a big city, it would cost you a cool million to do that.
Wow. What's the average time from becoming a lawful resident to a citizen? What's the average time?
Well, it's either going to be the 5 years or the 3 year period if you're married to a U.S. citizen.
But what do people actually take?
Normally, in our area, because most of the green cards that we see are family based, they're not married to a U.S. citizen, they're family based, so usually a 5 year period, I would say. We see a few 3 year periods, but it's mostly all 5 years.
So it's a pretty steady track.
Yeah.
They don't just take it as they don't do their own time frame. It's a pretty steady.
Well, we got a huge influx a couple of years ago because in 1989 you had the big special agricultural worker green card and the legalization that Ronald put into effect. And guess what? A couple of years ago, they turned 50-20 or they turned 55-15 and they no longer had to speak, read, and write English, and we got a huge uptick in applications for citizenship. So they waited that long and then applied to become a U.S. citizen.
So that's when we saw this huge wave of people that would have been 20 years with their permanent resident card to Ronald Reagan, and now they're 13 years or older, so we have that big wave of people being now eligible to take in their primary language.
Yeah, do you have a breakdown in that? I imagine you do. Of the 880,000 in the state, how many years they've held green cards? You know that?
I'm sure somebody keeps that type of data, but I don't.
Interesting. Another was, is your budget directly proportional to your amount of applicants? Or is the does it go to like a general pool and then they fix it?
No, it's a general pool from Washington, D.C. Okay. It goes out into all sorts of different budget allocation things for real estate and office. That's all paid directly out of Washington, so we never see that part of the budget. I get a certain amount for supplies. I get a certain amount for overtime. I get a certain amount for travel. And then the things we pay locally, like cable service and some other things. And that's basically what our budget is for the year. We normally don't see all the other stuff. It's all handled out of Washington and paid out to the lessee that we're leasing the building from and all the other stuff. Ma'am?
Do green cards have a time period?
Green cards are valid for 10 years. They have an expiration date on them.
And then
now what that means is the card expires. Your lawful permanent resident status doesn't, but the card does, because at the end of 10 years we want new biometrics, and so we can update the card. We know who you are. We got a trail there of what you now look like after 10 years. Come in and take your fingerprints. We also know if you've done anything bad in the 10 years that might make you deportable from the United States.
So that's one of the other reasons that people want to naturalize, because even though it says permanent resident card, now they know it's not permanent.
Yeah.
It expires, you have to pay or lose it.
One thing anecdotally, we had somebody come in the other day that's had a green card since 1967.
Yes. And those didn't have any expiration dates on them. They're still out there. Mm-hmm. Up until a few years ago, I used to see quite regularly the green blue card that was issued back in the 50s. Mm-hmm. Okay, but as people travel, when they come back in the country, Customs and Border Protection is scarfing those up and say, yeah, we're keeping this. You need to go apply for a new card.
And there's a lot of misunderstanding and lack of communication that people understand, think that it's a permanent card forever because it doesn't expire.
It's like a driver's license, okay? Driver's license expires after 5 or 6 years or whatever, and the driver's people want your new biometrics, and they want you to come in and take an eye test and all that sort of stuff.
So if I applied, sent in my application, and while my application was in the process of being approved, my green card expired.
That's not a problem, unless an employer wants to see it. Okay, if an employer wants to check your legal status to work for him or her, that could become a problem because of the employer. It's not a problem for us because we know you're still a lawful permanent resident and we are not going to charge you for a green card, so you can become a citizen and pay for that before you ever see your green card, because it takes about a year to produce a green card these days.
Is it different for what country you're coming from, the green card process?
No. The process itself is all the same. It's the different countries is how long it takes for there to be a visa number available. Okay. That's the only difference.
We also have a large number of people that come in and want us to assist them doing the replacement because it's expiring, and we convince them that you might as well become a citizen if you've had it for 30, 40 years, and you actually become a citizen faster
than getting a green card
replacement card. So we get a lot of those folks that have no clue of all the benefits. So we spend a lot of time on that as well.
Do you spend a lot of your time educating people? I mean, is that
not as much as I would like, because I still have a field office to run that I'm responsible for. So, I get out as often as I can. I've got 8 counties that we visit, and so.
But as pastor,
as often as I can get out, even if it's just during the day, if I don't have a budget to stay overnight, I will always try to get out if I possibly can.
And he does it more than beyond. And like Pastor Alex mentioned, they give us all the materials they can think of. They answer our phone calls. They're very flexible. They go out of their way to sometimes pay their own food to get out here and do much more than any other district office does for us. We're very fortunate.
And we're very thankful that you've been in Holden 3 times now. I feel like every time you come, you're sharing this information with folks that then go down the mountain and hopefully spread out.
No, we enjoy it.
Yeah, we enjoy it.
I wish I could do it full time.
I know.
They won't let me.
Well, when you're here, you're full time. You're answering questions, you talk to people, you're open.
And no one can get a hold of me. Up until I get about 50 feet off the dock in Chalet,
and my iPhone goes bonkers. Hopefully nobody's been arrested, so tomorrow we'll have 15 citizens.
What other questions can I answer for you?
Everybody awake?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when we go on an outreach, basically, Annabelle always comes with me because she is bilingual and does a fantastic job. And I've gotten to the point where if it's a primarily Hispanic audience, I just let her go. I stopped doing the translation thing. I just let her do the whole thing. But basically, my officers are not there to fail anybody. They're there to give everybody an equal opportunity to succeed. And the last thing we want to do is fail anybody, because then you have to write this big old long denial. All involved. It has to go through my senior ISO, then it has to come through me. Sometimes it has to go over to Seattle and the attorneys over there. It's just a big pain. It is much easier to put an approval stamp on an application and sign your name. So we will give them every opportunity to succeed, not necessarily because we're being nice to them, but because we're being nice to ourselves.
And we have witnessed a tremendous amount of dollars that they save on attorney fees to the people that we serve. I mean, I witnessed that in many capacities.
But we're not attorneys and we cannot give legal advice. Please understand that. And we don't.
David, you had a question or a comment or anything to suggest to this friend?
We're on investment visas from England. So we own the bed and breakfast in Manhattan. All I will say is, it was easier to get the original one in England than it is to renew the damn thing. So basically what happened, 2 years ago, we come in 5 years ago, and the visa ran out in December 2012. So we phoned up and said, can we do this here, or do we got to go back to England? No, you can do it here, sir. You need to fill out this form. But don't fill it out and send it prior to 60 days before the visa runs out. Okay, that's what we did. So we sent it off, filled it out, sent it off. We get a letter in December saying, please supply the green card that was attached to your passport when you entered the country. Okay, send it off. February time, we get another letter to say, please supply photocopies of every page of your passports in color. Okay, send it off. So in May come and went, we never heard nothing. The bed and breakfast was busy. September come, and it was like, oh, we've not heard. Okay, so we phoned him up and said, we've not heard. Oh, hang on a minute. Oh, we're sending you a letter on the 27th of May. Oh, sorry, we've never received it. Can you send me a copy? Oh, no, can't do that, sir. We've packed the file off to the National Records Office. You need to apply for this under the Freedom of Information Act. So we did that. So the first letter went back with the help of Norma and Gustavo. Guess what? Come back. Now, we don't know who you are. You've not filled it out correctly. We need this, that, the other, and you know. So we filled it all out, sent it off. I got fed up in the end, and I took it to Dave Reichardt and said, I'm done.
No names, please.
You need to.
Get an attorney.
Yeah. Well, no, it was just to help. And he sorted it out, and it got to the stage where it was now becomes a legal issue, so he can't help. So we got an attorney, and we filled out all the forms, and it cost you a fortune. And about 5 weeks ago, this much paper went off to Nogales, California.
But you're legally at Holy Village, right?
Yeah, we're legally. So it's quite funny because
we don't deport anybody.
We're in the process, and when my father comes, my father comes from England the day before, and he comes for 3 months. He's just gone home, and he always says, I'm more legal than you. So we're in the process. It's just a nightmare, you know, and, you know, it's...
And my office does not process those visas.
Okay, that's good to know.
It's good to know, but I wish you did. But it's difficult, those sort of... When we went to England, we had an immigration lawyer in England, did it all for us, and we went, and we invited to the American Embassy, and we sit down, and we go in. We were there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and we go in, and we sit down in this big room. The number comes up. We go to the desk and give it all over. And the girl says behind the glass screen, "Oh, you've been to a lawyer. You don't need to do that. You can do it online. We don't need that for this. Give you a ticket. Go and sit down. You'll get called again. 5 minutes later, we get called to another window around the corner, and the gentleman behind the screen says, thank you very much. Oh, it's really nice to see someone going to America that's not going to Florida. Have a nice time. There's the yellow slip. Go to counter 43 again and pay some more money. Come back. I give him the... He said, okay, now there's a blue slip. Go to the counter at the back of the hall and pay some more money to the courier firm to get your passports back. Enjoy your life in America. Goodbye. And that was it. Done. We were out by 10 to 9. And the lawyer had given us all this stuff about, oh, you're gonna, you know, you're gonna go in and have an interview and you're gonna, you know, there could be really nasty and all things like that. And it was like, really?
This is one of so many stories, you guys. It's a perfect example. But I know one day we're gonna have a naturalization ceremony for Dave and Angie at Holden Village.
One thing that I want to mention for everybody, if you travel outside the country, you know, more than once a year, it's always nice, and I just did this about 2 weeks ago. You fill out application online, it becomes a thing called GOES. It's G-O-E-S. They send you like a green card. It's like if when you go through, instead of going to customs, there's a machine.
It's like a Nexus thing.
Yes, you place your passport there.
Yes, for the airport or the airports that have the kiosks for the passport.
Yeah, it's like one of the main, like, you know, big, the big ones.
The first time I saw one of those was coming back from the Nick Perdomo Tobacco Factory paid vacation I took in Nicaragua last year. Came back from there and went through Miami. That's a good time there, Alex.
Yeah, it costs $100 for 5 years. And it's basically like today, and this happens to me that every time I was coming through, they either said, you know, send me on the side or go to, it used to be because it was different names with my name or same name but different. Anyways, it was, so they took
it everything. It was pretty slick. I had to admit, the first time I'd seen it, you just scanned your passport and they said, yeah, go ahead. And you took a little slip from the machine, walked up to the customs immigration guy, and he just waved you on through.
Wow. Yeah, it's all right,
I like this.
10 minutes interview.
Wow. Nice.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.